So here we are then, the week in which we come up to All Souls Day, All Saints Day, All Hallows Eve, and Halloween. And as I always try to coincide this particular lecture when we're doing science fiction and film and television with one of those other allegedly, or indeed conceivably, umbrella genres, which is horror, which many of you will have encountered in some way, shape or form, if not all of you. It's not going to be too scary a lecture, but then again, maybe, who knows? I'm not going to put any disclaimers out. But what I'm going to actually attempt to do over the next 45 minutes or thereabouts is take you through really the kind of thinking that you might want to apply if you either chose to do the science fiction and intertextuality essay, or indeed if you actually went slap bang down the line of horror cycles frequently emerge in times of social stress. Please discuss this with reference to postmodernism and horror. So hopefully, either through playing back the podcast or actually listening today and making occasional notes, it might give you a few pointers into some of the sort of areas I would suggest you possibly look at if you do either of those particular essay titles. Arguably, there are also other areas that come across as well, but it's not directly related as the superhero was probably to the archetypes and stereotypes question as well. But why the title The Horror Syndrome? Well, as long as humanity has actually gathered around campfires and there have been things in the dark, things beyond, there's always been that tendency to actually have anxiety, tension. The reason we actually have central nervous systems is because we can react to fight or flight. Our adrenaline systems have developed over the years to effectively provide us with exactly that. So evolutionarily, they have been very structured ways in which we've developed this. But one of the other areas in terms of what I'm going to talk about today is really related to, just as we've talked about science philosophy, the whole notion of the philosophy of horror. It's kind of language that Noel Carroll started developing in the text of the same name, which really starts to unpick the rationale, certainly over the last 140 years, in terms of why is it that we have particularly enjoyed horror as a form of entertainment, both in the concept of the theatre and latterly in the terms of the film experience and, of course, television as well. All of those areas have developed the whole notion of a popularity. A cynic might turn around and say it's simply because they're relatively cheap to make, or horror can be a very cheap genre to effectively make. But maybe there are a few other areas that need to be considered as well, and maybe there are a few other aspects that we can look towards, including the theatrical history of horror. Or, as Richard Hand refers to it, the Grand Guignol. This notion, this Parisian theatre that was established towards the end of the 19th century, and lasted pretty much up until the Second World War, in which you would go down the back streets of Montmartre, you would be encouraged to effectively sort of, you know, make sure that you'd made arrangements for your family because you were going to be presented with something that was so horrendous, so unspeakably terrible and horrific that your life may never be the same again. And we see in terms of the early Grand Guignol Theatre, certainly evidence of the sort of things which manifested in the late 20th century in terms of the notion of splatter movies, in terms of chainsaw massacres, in terms of, again, the psychological horrors that come through and manifest themselves. So there's a direct relevance to that. But you might well be saying, yes, 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 this is all well and good, but what about science fiction in film and television? How does that relate to it? Well, bear with me. Hopefully we'll sort of demonstrate that in a number of key ways. Kim Newman certainly does this. And those of you who read Empire magazine regularly will probably be quite familiar with the writings of Kim Newman. His book Nightmare Movies is still a very excellent go-to text to actually get a general flavour of the way it's kind of reflected society. And actually, in many ways, acted as a cathartic element in society, relating to how we actually view horror. And why, just as I'll show you in a few weeks' time, horror shares a lot in common with comedy, in terms of the psychological ways in which it goes for the gag reflex or the start or the jump, etc., This is another sort of aspect that, again, unpicks the whole notion of where we're seeing horror develop. Jordan Peele with Get Out, very much a movie of its own time, the early parts, the second decade of the 21st century, dealing with race issues and so on. And again, his other sort of work, Jordan Peele, obviously, the man who's effectively carrying the flame of Rod Serling's Twilight Zone into the 21st century. So what's one of the most standard tropes within horror? Well, there you have it. The house on the hill, or the last house at the end of the street, or the house that seemingly is abandoned, or the Addams Family house on Mockingbird Lane, or other sort of aspects that come through. Actually, I think it's the Munsters who are Mockingbird Lane. The Addams Family have to check their particular area. But you're still dealing with something which is beyond. It is, quite literally, alien to us. And it's no surprise whatsoever that Ridley Scott transposed most of the tropes, together with Dan O'Bannon, obviously, of the haunted house into outer space with the film Alien. It's very much seen in that basis. In Psycho, which is probably much more directly connected with what we would understand as a pure horror genre, Hitchcock again makes use of the elements that suggest that the greatest horrors are the unimagined ones, the ones that we think about, the ones that are just off-screen. He does this with The Birds as well, which is arguably probably his closest science fiction film in terms of obviously the environmental problems that occurs that when birds and normally perfectly sane seagulls, etc., start going feral, and the whole issue with respect to that. But Psycho, certainly it's the Bates Motel, which is the haunted house. That abandoned motel that unfortunately Janet Leigh's character ends up in, and obviously the interconnection with respect to the character of Norman Bates and his mother and the interlinking side of things within that. And Wes Craven's Last House on the Left, again, fairly self-evident. It's that haunted house element that's coming through there. The next one that comes through very much as an active side of this horror genre and horror trope is the overreacher. And this is one of the reasons why you'd say, well, surely this is the Frankenstein myth writ large. We're back in Mary Shelley's territory. We're back in week one. We've merged sort of six weeks ago back to Shelley's Frankenstein, and the notion that Victor Frankenstein effectively is punished for hubris, punished for pride. This thing I talked about last week in terms of nemesis and hubris and pride. What happens when you effectively are trying to go beyond what we're meant to know? The warnings that are actually there, the challenges that are effectively sort of present within that whole field, and so on. Elements of the overreacher. Well, we've already talked about Frankenstein, but Reanimator also fulfills that whole side of things. How often do you see the notion of the mad scientist, the scientist who goes too far, whether it's Seth Brundle in The Fly, whether it's the creators of the Jurassic World scenarios in Jurassic Park, whether it's the Westworld sort of people who are actually sort of going just that step too far. It would all be okay if only they kind of didn't actually push to the next stage onwards. And equally, I've talked about the alien, which is very much at the heart of so much space invasion, film and literature and text, etc. But ultimately, Orientalism. This weekend, I think I'll be meeting up with Bram Stoker's great-grandson, I think, who's doing a piece with us at Great Yarmouth for all places. But Bram Stoker very much wasn't the first person to actually notably write about vampires. That actually goes back to John Polidori and Mary Shelley back in the day. But certainly Stoker's creation of Dracula in the last years of the 19th century tapped into a very real fear of the immigrant, fear of the migrant, fear of the Eastern European. Because here we are, or here we were in London, Eastern Europeans not speaking English perhaps fully, or perhaps they were actually speaking English very eloquently and very articulately, but they were still strange. They were other. And ultimately that is one of the key elements when it comes to horror that comes across time and time again, that actually there is this concern about what lies outside our particular group, our particular social area, our particular social environment. Is it going to disrupt the harmony? Is it going to be something which is going to be dominant? Is it going to take us over? Etc., etc. You know, the images of the Martians in War of the Worlds, again, very much sort of distinctly other in terms of how they relate to us and so on. But certainly when you've actually got the vampiric myth that, again, has emerged time and time again, you've got the space vampire in Star Trek, the episode The Man Trap. You've got the literal vampires of Life Force, a movie of the 1980s, etc. And you've got the whole notion of how vampire, the sucking of energy, is a constant theme that kind of emerges in an awful number of texts within this. And Dracula obviously has emerged, actually quite literally, if you look through some of the sort of recent incarnations of the X-Men and indeed the sort of vampiric sort of elements within that whole side of things, crossing over into mainstream culture, Buffy the Vampire Slayer and so on and so forth. You've got that whole essence of Dracula, the ruler of Transylvania, Vlad the Impaler, sort of the roots of how Dracula sort of emerged from his whole routine, and again, the sort of damnation that comes with respect to that. Which also ties into vampires, lycanthropes, and all of the usual kind of standard horror tropes that emerge as a matter of course, and which frequently kind of cross over, dog soldiers being another case in point, where you can have science fiction tropes mixed and matched with horror ones in a way that kind of interlinks and creates an overall overarching theme. In an era where Alzheimer's and the notion of forgetting things and losing one's particular sense of who one is could be seen to be arguably one of the greatest terrors of all, this notion has constantly been replayed in horror through doppelgangers, through changelings, the replacement at birth by the fairies of a sort of replacement child. But what about the whole notion of indeed the replacement self? What do we mean by self? We talked a great deal, and certainly the Black Mirror series talks a great deal about how the sense of self is important, the sense of identity. Does that change when you have a virtual self? Does it relate when it's online and so on? And what happens if it's actually lost? How do you actually get it back? When your identity as who you think you actually are is taken away from yourself and suddenly you're left as nothing, really. Or an alternate. The whole tragedy of Lon Chaney Jr., or Bruce Banner, arguably, is that they lose their selves. Or maybe they find themselves. But basically, when they metamorphose and become either the Incredible Hulk, or the Wolfman, or they connect on that basis, or Dr. Jekyll takes his potion and ceases to be the mild-mannered Henry Jekyll and becomes instead the bullying, aggressive, dominant Mr. Hyde, how does that sort of again relate to our own individuality? Is it also playing around also from a psychological point of view of schizophrenia? Different voices, multiple personality types, multiple texts, all of which are quite unnerving, because if you don't know what kind of character you're going to speak to, you don't know basically whether somebody's going to be nicey nice or horrendous or a complete bastard. You don't know. You're uncertain. It raises concerns about where you actually deliver sessions and so on. And talking about sessions, what about The Exorcist? Or, again, many classic examples of science fiction. Again, the likes of Zeta, episode of the original Star Trek series, where human beings are actually possessed. Deep Space Nine plays a great deal with the Par Wraiths, sort of elements of that whole side of things, and how we again lose ourselves for a time because we're actually sort of possessed by other beings, spirits, and so on. And maybe, as I say, this also boils down to what we like about fear in general. That you can actually see fear primarily as being an acronym for false expectations appearing real. It's a kind of variation on the notion that we rarely have anything to fear except fear itself. But somehow we quite like that as well. It's the reason we like roller coaster rides, or some of us do. It's the reason we like that scary movie element that we can actually say at the end of the evening, at the end of the screening, it's okay, it's only a movie. It's the reason, from a postmodern impact, Wes Craven played around with it so much in the Scream series, in which you would actually identify the kind of classical tropes that you would actually see time and time again, where you know that the blonde female should not go into that dark dungeon alone, but you still see them actually echoing that process. And again, the sort of notion of sexism and elements coming across with that is also being changed and inverted as people actually find new things to explore, new things to address, and so on. The movie that we're seeing tomorrow, actually, Interstellar, on one level could be seen as partially horrific. It's an apocalyptic scenario. It's a time where basically the Earth is faced with effectively dust storms, dust bowls, etc. And we're having to go ultimately into that unknown, into that big dark void, that big dark scary void of space and so on. So, what happens in terms of the narrative tropes? If we look at some of the characteristics, etc., what happens when we start talking about how horror itself develops within the film? Well, usually you find that there is some initial encounter that manifests itself. And that, as Carol would say, is the onset. It's usually experienced by a limited number of individuals, or in some cases, just a single individual. Because that enables, obviously, the notion of disbelief to come into play. That somehow, once you've actually encountered the green-eyed blob from the planet X, you somehow have to convince other people that's the case. Or, in the case of Possession, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Classic trope, which obviously sort of addresses the fear of the Red Menace in 1950s America, and the notion of a way of life being undermined by a different ideology, by people who you normally would expect to actually recognise as being the same as yourself, somehow having completely different viewpoints. How can you trust somebody who looks like somebody you've always known, talks like somebody you've always known, but has a fundamental different belief system? Whether that's a member of the family, whether that's a close friend, all of these key things can actually lead on from that initial encounter to, I don't believe you. That kind of sense that somehow people are raising the concern about the monster that lives on the hill. There are sort of issues being raised, and yet nobody's actually believing it. It's like the little boy who cried wolf, and in the end basically he was swallowed by the wolf in all sorts of ways from that point of view. But again, we kind of quite like this because it fulfills that whole criteria of, as we saw actually with Event Horizon, you can't possibly actually have that experience from, you know, a black hole created. It's never going to happen. You're not really seeing your long-lost son, you're not really seeing so-and-so, you're not etc., etc., you're not really seeing hell, you're not... until suddenly it's actually right slap bang in the middle that actually, yes, it is real, and that reality comes back to bite the protagonists. In other words, there's a confirmation that that disbelief, that suspension of belief that's actually needed for our enjoyment suddenly actually becomes true. I was never really a fan of the found footage series of movies, which kind of was really kicked off by Blair Witch Project in the late 90s. But at the same time, it plays around with that whole notion that somehow this is material that's been left on the moon, whether it's been left in a whole sort of area that suddenly you see that very shaky camera work that sort of denounces it. But it's working very much using these particular elements and formulae. In fact, actually, I'd say Blair Witch Project's probably the worst movie I've ever seen, but I'll debate that another time. Once things have been confirmed, there's usually some kind of confrontation. whether that's actually from a superheroic point of view, going head to head with Thanos, or whether it's something against the notion of the Doctor taking on board the evil Daleks or whomever, but there is something that effectively sees a battle. I mean, ultimately, that's it. Drama thrives on conflict. So good versus evil, quite literally, is at the heart of this whole sort of experience. And although technically we would expect good to always triumph, usually it has to be very, very careful, and there are issues relating to that that all expand and develop within the narrative and how we see the narrative evolving and so on. But there is, as I say, that confrontation that impacts in terms of people's effects and so on. And sure enough, because these movies are 90, 110, 120, 130 minutes in length, sometime, or indeed the TV series, even if it's stretched out, as in American Horror Story or in various other lines over a particular period of time, there is a form of resolution. Obviously not a complete resolution, because that would actually close the road to sequels. Dracula is never completely dead, or is he? Frankenstein is never completely dead, or is he? And so on and so forth. There's always that notion that there's a certain open-endedness, because we don't really want the story to end, do we? I mean, we do on one level, and say, whew, we've recovered from that one. But then we're eager for another story, another tale. One of the most interesting philosophies that has emerged over the last 40, 50 years, quite some time now, is that which was put forward by Baudrillard, B-A-U-D-R-I-L-L-A-R-D. Baudrillard, Frenchman, passed away a few years ago, who effectively claims that, as far as Western culture was concerned, we were little more than virtual symbols adrift in a sea of reality, or unreality. Virtual symbols adrift in a sea of unreality. And certainly we come to this when we start talking about The Matrix, in itself quite an interesting science fiction experience of loss of self, loss of identity, choosing of pathways. Do you take the red pill? Do you take the blue pill? Which experience do you actually go to discover who and what you actually are? Are you a real live human being, or are you simply a power source for computer-based batteries? It's the same sort of negotiation that we see in terms of the ongoing line of the Terminator. Terminator recently saw the Dark Fate scenario, and you've got all of the favourites back. You've got, quite literally, Linda Hamilton using the phrase, "I'll be back," in a nice, ironic, postmodern way, and Arnold Schwarzenegger's back, and so on and so forth. And yet we're having a slight twist on tail, because we're dealing with Mexicans. We're dealing with, obviously, a narrative trope that also starts addressing the whole notion of the contemporary issues with respect to America and its southern neighbours. Fear of the unknown, perhaps. Developments relating to that. How are things tied into that? How does the fear of the machine, the fear of the technology, emerge in terms of that? And you might well also argue, so if postmodernism is where we are kind of now, although some have actually said we're in a post-postmodern age, what actually launched the whole thing? Well, actually it was modernity. The whole notion of the modern age back in the 1920s and 30s, yes? If I was able to give you an answer, it would be a wrong one. Because actually, the point about postmodernism is you cannot have a simple definition of it. You can take it from the point of view of what comes after modernity, as one point. So modernism is a kind of notion where you can structure things like the structuralists do in terms of binary oppositions. You can have black and white, good and evil, male and female, up and down, above, below, and so on. But if you start talking about postmodernism, it's involving elements of intertextuality. It's involving elements with that which actually take different kind of texts and basically gives meaning to everything. Everything has a certain kind of meaning. This is the whole point of Baudrillard's thesis in terms of how he would view the postmodern world and the postmodern society. In a world where everything means everything, then does anything mean anything? How do you actually relate to that? And it's playing around with that whole notion of, on the one hand, it's very exciting. On the other hand, it's very confusing. So if anybody ever turns around and says, you can define postmodernism like this, they're probably wrong. You need to actually sort of work through that whole process and again look at the sort of concepts that come through in terms of attempts to scratch the surface of what postmodernism is. With respect to postmodernism and horror, though, it's best seen by what has been styled as the first postmodern horror movie, which was indeed Scream in the 1990s, because it raised issues of being self-aware. It raised the issue of the protagonists were aware of the kind of narrative tropes that they were working through. Galaxy Quest does the same kind of thing from a kind of science fiction mode, etc. So to a large extent does The Orville in terms of television series, which actually use humour to develop sort of various other elements within that. But with respect to this particular area, we often find that when it comes to actually poking fun at horror and becoming almost postmodernistic in approach, they tend to occur roughly in 20-year cycles. These are ballpark figures. You can look back to the 1920s and the onset of characters such as Nosferatu and the first group of the Universal movie monsters, James Whale's Frankenstein, Bram Stoker, obviously Bela Lugosi's incarnation of Dracula. And that initial fright development that went through, the genuine horror from that perspective, changed and evolved, and within about 10 to 15 years, we had a situation towards the 40s, etc., where Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein, Abbott and Costello meet the Invisible Man, and so on. You have the whole notion of Scary Movie, the Scary Movie franchise, which is a complete spoof of the Scream series and more, where they'll sort of borrow all sorts of tropes that come in and actually effectively invite the audience to poke fun at them. And once you've actually reached the stage where horror films become self-parodying, then actually they cease to be horror and become more comedy. So as I say, if we return to the 1920s and early 30s, those four films in particular were probably templates in what we would regard as horror movies, but also using elements that we would latterly sort of say as, well, yes, but you're dealing with the scientists, you're looking at various other aspects within that. I mean, Todd Browning's Freaks, which was banned for about 20 or 30 years on release because it was dealing with a group of carnival inhabitants and people who were actually working within the sort of field from there, all sort of echo this whole theme of the unsure, the unknown, the uncanny elements. With the advent of colour, of course, Hammer also launches its way, although Hammer's early successors were solid science fiction entries. They introduced Quatermass to the whole thing. So we had Quatermass in the Pit, we had the Quatermass Experiment, we had X the Unknown, which in themselves were movie adaptations of the BBC television series of the same name, which again were in that immediate 1950s post-war horror of the nuclear age, the sort of development within that, and the sense that actually underneath these bombed out sites in London, maybe there were other things being disturbed. Maybe there were, as they say, signs of the devils, or signs in the case of Quatermass and the Pit of an earlier infestation of Martians that effectively attempted to obviously develop a sort of base within Earth, etc., using all of the kind of characteristics of humanity that we would normally put down as being unacceptable, tendency to murder, tendency to effectively live down to our lowest impulses and so on. Again, tendency to go back to the days of primitive. It's loss of self. Loss of self as seen through the primitive, that somehow when we actually encounter the deep-rooted part of ourselves which is primitive, which is actually down underneath, suddenly there's a whole range of other issues to be developed, etc. As indeed Freud and also Jung actually talk about in terms of the collective unconscious in Jung's case as well. And then after the 1950s, of course, the 1970s, we get the notion of the picket fence horror, the horror which is contemporary, the horror which, unlike Hammer and its gothic horror, and the previous gothic horror, where it's horror set in the relatively recent past. This is horror in the here and now. This is horror that effectively, in the case of Rosemary's Baby, in the case of The Exorcist, in the case of David Lynch's Blue Velvet, takes place quite literally in the centre of America at this moment in time. Plays around with that sort of aspect. Just as, I say, Jordan Peele does the same thing in that point as well. And John Carpenter, of course, also did Escape from New York and a whole range of other sort of elements. John Carpenter's entry into the sequence Halloween, with, of course, the intertextual link being that the mask that we see in Halloween is that of William Shatner in his Captain James Cook personification, and so on and so forth. So you get lots of nods to that direction as well in terms of how you see things being developed. And Halloween itself, arguably, is something which has kind of been imported and built on almost lock, stock and pumpkin from the United States, from that whole essence of trick or treat. Although, if you dig deeper into the actual origins of Halloween, it's a very Celtic-oriented area. So you've kind of got a two-way process whereby the Irish and the Scots, who kind of exported many of their Celtic religions and thoughts to America, we're now getting it back in terms of a repackaged version, etc.
Would you say Halloween is set to sci-fi?
You could put a case for it. Yeah.
All my new ones, it's more like sort of like origin, like orientated, like, you know, like witchcraft. And stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, the stalk and slash material that comes across within that, and I've eliminated things like Friday the 13th and so on, but it does sort of connect with that.
Could you make the link between science fiction and dark magic in particular regards,
yeah,
especially with the works of Aleister Crowley?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the weird science and the notion of the cry of Cthulhu and the other elements that come across from that whole side of things, yes. I mean, it's one of those scary sort of elements where you're looking at the unbidden, and even his Dark Materials kind of uses the whole notion of darkness and the uncanny. You know, the X-Men actually had the prefix the uncanny X-Men in their original incarnation to actually start noting the whole element of what we understand by the uncanny and how things are seen as beyond our ken, really. You know, there are more things in heaven and life, Horatio, than dreamt of in our poor philosophy. I mean, that doesn't mean Hamlet science fiction. It doesn't mean that when you start talking about the cloud-capped towers, the golden palaces, and the notion of the tempest and Prospero's speech there, that's not science fiction. Although, all of the tropes that were used in The Tempest are used and manifest in the movie Forbidden Planet. Lifted, lock, stock and barrel, pretty much, from that point of view. So you've got an adaptation within that whole field. And of course there is the Scottish play, which we won't mention the title because it's far too scary to actually mention at this particular time, but Leon Macduff. Well, you said it. Something like the Japanese horror and the notion of the ring, again, starts playing around with that whole notion of how that is seen, the child crawling out of the well, the video image that we actually see with that. There's an awful lot of horror, and again, I mentioned earlier the work of the Dark Mirror universe from that point of view, and how that's also opening up in its own sort of way, Charlie Brooker's sort of line, in terms of how loss of self is in how we're relating to the new technologies, how in many ways that's providing a world, an environment in which many people are still, on some instinctive level, quite unnerved by, quite concerned by. Everything's fine, everything seems to be working perfectly, but what happens when the power goes? What happens? Do we actually develop into a kind of pre-industrial stage with all of the challenges that might be incarnated within that? Do we have the virus issue that actually comes across and is certainly at the heart of so much of, yes, the Z word, the zombie, the whole notion of how zombies in many ways kind of, they've also sort of changed from being very much related to religion and the sort of notion of the dark arts of voodoo and so on, right the way through now, of course, there can be anything from just literally a vaccine that's gone incorrect and kind of has caused a plague to actually go through society and so on and so forth. Again, that sort of horror in terms of how we see things operating as well. Is The Walking Dead science fiction? Not really. But then again, actually, yeah, I can see how it could be developed within that intertextual element within that. And I've spoken about how Scream was very much regarded as being the first postmodern science fiction film which actually deliberately makes use of signs and signifiers like Freddy Krueger's jumper as from Nightmare on Elm Street, which emerges in the sort of janitor's sort of outfit. You see so many sort of aspects if you follow the movie Scream, which actually sort of relate to other horror movies and are knowing nods in the direction of audiences that kind of appreciate the homage to the field. And this brings us round to the main aspect that I want to actually use as an example today of something which relates to both horror and to science fiction in a way which I think still actually pretty much stands alone. Oh, maybe not quite alone, but it does actually provide an excellent viewpoint of intertextuality. Has anybody got any idea what it refers to? I'm going back to that question, because I mean, there's a big line there. Notice how, in this particular case, I have deliberately put in, or at least rather the screenwriter put in, a hyphen. So it's not postmodernism, one word, which is often there, but it's postmodern Prometheus. What do you think it's referring to? Yes.
Frankenstuff.
Sorry?
Is it Frankenstuff?
Is it what stuff?
Frankenstuff.
Frankenstuff.
Frankenstein.
Frankenstein, yes, Frankenstein. Yeah, I mean, certainly that's absolutely right, because the subtitle for Shelley's original work was Frankenstein or The Modern Prometheus. Here we have a situation from a TV show which lasted for 10 seasons, actually, it was arguably 12, actually, which very much flagged up this whole essence of being of its time, seeing how science can actually relate and interconnect within the whole side of things, etc. In the episode we're going to see, which is the postmodern Prometheus, you have a number of clear, classic postmodern linkages, and a lot of intertextual links as well, which you can use as example A, example B, and so on and so forth. It would almost, if you chose this, actually write your essay, either of those, science fiction and intertextuality, or indeed the horror ones, kind of for you up to a point. The Great Mutato. Has anybody identified what it is as yet? Okay, it's all right. Mutation suggests that things are changing. You're adjusting. If you're using a mutato, it could be like potato, it could be a whole change of this. In fact, the first shot that we actually see is of a shot of a comic which actually is entitled The Great Mutato. So it's actually raising that notion of making the audience self-aware and building the notion of what is this character? Who is this character? We also see the main scientist in this particular area is a character called Dr. Polidori. Double L as opposed to single L. But of course it was John Polidori who was privy to the writings of Mary Shelley and Percy Shelley and Lord Byron. And John Polidori, who also wrote a text called The Vampire back in 1826, which also led on, obviously, to the whole notion of bringing in the vampiric lore and legends and so on and so forth. And lo and behold, this is the name of one of the characters that we're about to see in terms of the postmodern Prometheus. Very popular for a long, long time in terms of American TV. In many ways, I suppose, the Jeremy Kyle aspect was built on this when he still had a show. But reality television. How much more modern can you get than actually wanting to define your existence and define your experience by actually being part of a TV show? Because if you're not on TV, then maybe you don't exist at all. Because people can't validate your own existence. You can't validate your own existence. And we see interwoven within the text this sort of element of the Jerry Springer Show and how things are developed within a particular branch of American culture, in which actually, yes, the ultimate is for your small town of villagers to actually be made popular by appearing on the Jerry Springer Show. A movie one of you may have recalled, but look it up on IMDb if you wish, starring Cher, called Mask, a few years ago, all about how character has to put a mask on to face the public and so on and so forth. It's not to do with the mask, in case you all the work that was put together with Cameron Diaz's first movie, but it's literally called Mask. And again, why do people wear masks? To again hide their public image, or show a public image and keep their private image personal and private. Eric Stoltz is the character who actually also plays the character of the mask again. He emerges in the text as well. And I've already said that Cher, as in Sonny, as in Gypsies, Tramps and Thieves, as in a fair number of areas, including, of course, appearing in Witches of Eastwick, is also a key character in this particular production. So here we have a fictional world which is already making use of things which the audience are expected to be connecting with. Jerry Springer, Cher, Mask, and so on and so forth. And the characters that we first see in this particular show are two young men who astonishingly are, just like Sophie, off to a comic convention. Wow. Comic-Con. They're off to Comic-Con to actually see a whole range of things. Actually, you've been postponed, so it's great. And ultimately, that's also nodding in the direction of the audience. Because a large number of people who are going to be tuning into a show which is science fiction oriented, which in itself has actually been built on the back of The Twilight Zone and very much inspired by Kolchak Nightstalker and other classics within the whole area, has also developed this whole line of how do we relate to fans? How the fans connect with this whole side of things? The tune Walking in Memphis, sung by Cher, but originally by Mark Cohen, is also featured within this whole aspect. In fact, actually, I think there's around about 53, 54 is the maximum that any student's actually picked up in terms of intertextual links that come through from this particular thing. It's almost like one after the other, but strung in a narrative which also carries with it the whole notion of the fairy tale. Has anybody ever got any idea in terms of what the programme is as yet? Sorry? Is it what?
Sorry, I'm thinking about it.
All right, okay. Okay, well, we shall continue. If you actually look at one of the subtle visual clues, Dinah, again, very much at the heart of an American aspect of life and experience, the American diner, is actually in one frame, if you freeze frame it, shot in such a way that a shaft of sunlight effectively blocks out the eye. So, it's kind of DNER, or DNA, dinner. We're dealing with genetic modifications. DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, is the fundamental building block which makes us and tables and trees and geese, everything pretty much carbon-based life forms, the shape, the form, the kind of aspects that we're in. On a cellular building block, that's exactly what we're about. So, we've got Dr. Polidori, a mad scientist. We've got DNA. We've got Cher. We've got popular culture. We've got a title which suggests something that is postmodern, which is new, which is after the modern. Not quite postmodern, as I said, but is attempting to address that whole notion of what postmodernism actually is. And of course, we've got the whole notion of Prometheus from the original Frankenstein going down into the pit and maybe coming back with the secret of fire, for all the good that that will do us. Because obviously when you've got fire, that gives the villagers something that they can actually fly around with their torches and, as is often the case, burn them all. Let's have the villagers storming the castle, or the equivalent. All of these are things that are kind of classic narrative tropes. They become classic, become more, you might almost say, if I substituted cliche for classic, you might also see a way in which this is also being developed and evolved as well. Because a cliche, sometimes it's used as the pejorative, sometimes it's suggested that a cliche is just, you know, it's become so tired, it's boring, etc. Cliche is just like a truth that's overused. Or maybe, you know, say, used sort of frequently in terms of how we're seeing it, and so on. In other words, a quote to actually consider. This is a quote that actually emerges from the actual narrative itself and is well worth just actually taking a few seconds to have a little read through to outline that sort of whole area. And when I actually give you the source of this person, then maybe it may just actually tell you exactly where the series is from. Anyone had a chance to soak that up? Culture so obsessed by the media and the chance for self-dramatisation that they'll do anything in order to gain the spotlight. Does that help? If we say sort of Gene Roddenberry for Star Trek, if we say Joss Whedon for Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Firefly and so on, we say Straczynski for Babylon 5. Anybody ever heard of Chris Carter? No. Never heard of Chris Carter. Okay. You'll be sad about that. Another line that comes across from Chris Carter, who not only wrote this, but also directed this particular element, it's a fifth season show that we're about to see, is the whole aspect that comes in the dialogue between the two lead characters, who actually are named, and this should surely give it away now. I mean, if we've mentioned Chris Carter, we've mentioned the title, we've mentioned various other solutions, the two lead characters, male and female, who again play around with the whole notion of stereotypes, are Dana Scully and Fox Mulder. Oh, where's it from? Yay! Finally, okay. Characters actually standing out from that basis. The X-Files, which, as I say, very much established on the whole essence of being an investigation into ufologists, into the unknown. X marks the spot, X the unknown, and done in a way which obviously is a branch of the FBI, is literally put together not as a horror film, not as a horror show, but as a science fiction episode of the week, episodic episode, which starts exploring a whole range of elements. Although, again, in this particular aspect, they maybe take a couple of stages further. There's another quote that also comes from the whole thing, and again, bear this in mind when we're watching the sort of sequence, and indeed, if you get a chance, utilize Amazon Prime or whatever to look back over it if you follow through with this and see the way that this is actually developed. Because here, in case you were doubting and you were thinking, it's probably just accident or coincidence that you've actually just put in the postmodern Prometheus into the title. Here we clearly have, and Polidori was actually in there as well, here you clearly have a notion of, by name, Frankenstein is made quite explicit in the actual text. So it's not a case of simply turning around and saying, actually, there is a problem. A hideous phantasm of a man prefiguring the postmodern Prometheus. And what are the concerns at the end of the 20th century and heading into the 21st century? Genetics. Major concern. As I say, genetics can alter what it is to be human. It can make us better than human. It can make us post-human. It can make us, you know, into all sorts of conceivable ways. And the kind of things that we consume, the food that we eat, all of those aspects tie into the whole system. And again, if you're also raising that awareness of horror coming out and emerging from the time in which it's set, here we have something which is the reanimation of matter, genes into life, us only being as limited as the imagination of a scientist. Fantastic! Or is it a disaster? Because Oppenheimer, when he came up with the atomic bomb and they had the first test, actually noted for the phrase, I have become death, the destroyer of worlds. Something again we sort of see manifested in things like The Watchmen and Dr. Manhattan and so on. The power or the creativity of man and humanity could become the ultimate doom for humanity. All concerned with this whole notion of the ultimate horror. And yet it's using science to actually get through that sort of basis. And it's using science, which in theory, yes, the fruit fly, Drosophila, again, a reference to the classic David Hedison movie of the 1950s and the Jeff Goldblum version in the 1970s and so on. That whole notion of the fly and the horror that comes with that, which goes all the way back to that whole essence of how does pride, hubris, scientist as overreacher all tie into place within that? How do things sort of echo in terms of what we're seeing and how they're being delivered and so on? response that comes through from that little routine, from indeed Scully, is why would you actually reduce this character, this man, to a literary stereotype? So you're really seeing one of those classic examples of postmodernism that the authors and the writers and the characters are kind of addressing the audience directly. It's almost like breaking the fourth wall. It's like doing a Deadpool, if you want to use that line by Tim Miller, who of course also responsible for Terminator Dark Fate, so good stuff on that basis. And how you actually sort of see Tim Miller's work with Deadpool kind of changing, and indeed Callum Bunn from the comic book writer also writing his sort of notions of how suddenly our expectations of the character are subverted because that fourth wall is being consistently broken. And you're being invited into the whole notion of how things are developing and so on. Ibid, by the way, simply means it's the same quote. Okay, I'm presumably you're all familiar with that, so I'm putting Ibid on there. Opposite is when you, is what you'd use in your references if it wasn't exactly identical and it had been previously cited. And the concluding thing, of course, is that, you know, as if the thing hadn't reached the ultimate stage of where are we going with this, where is the writer? Because the original ending that's seen, that's developed, is a somewhat low-key, downbeat ending. It's not necessarily one which we kind of expect as being, you know, we want a bit more positivity in this. And so there's a change that actually you're almost invited to say has manifested itself in its own way. You can choose a better way. Okay, so that has concluded the initial side of things in terms of the lecturing side of things.